Welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I am John Charles, and I could not be more delighted to welcome back one of our favorite authors at the Poison Pen, KJ Dell'Antonia, who won our hearts last year with In Her Boots and previously with her novel, The Chicken Sisters. Now KJ is back with a bewitching new literary creation, Playing the Witch Card. Before we begin, I do want to let those listening in know the Poison Pen does have copies of all of KJ's books, and we would be happy to hold one or more for you or put them in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen Bookstore. Now, I would like to welcome back virtually KJ.
Thank you so much. I am really delighted to be here again.
Again, thank you. I'd like to start with you, if you are willing, having you talk a little bit about yourself prior to becoming a novelist, because like so many people, I think you were writing from early on in life, but that was never really a career possibility at first.
Yes, I did not grow up in a world where becoming an artist of any kind was viewed as a way to make money or be successful, or I came from let's have a steady job, and I actually don't regret that. So I went to law school, and then I had about 7 assorted steady jobs because it didn't necessarily really turn out to suit me. And then I was absolutely writing the whole time. And after I had my first kid, my husband, we were living in Manhattan. We needed to move. 9/11 had just happened. So this was obviously 20 some years ago. And I made a deal with my husband that we would move to the hinterlands for his job, as we did, but that we would hire a babysitter and it's the same as we would have if I had a leave the house job, but we moved to rural New Hampshire. There aren't very many leave the house jobs here. So I would throw myself at the writing thing. And I did.
And that led to the publication of your first novel, The Chicken Sisters.
Well, actually that led to the publication of 2 nonfiction books. Okay. Reading with Babies, Toddlers, and Twos, and then a long interval of being a journalist for various places, in culminating at the New York Times, and then and another nonfiction book, How to Be a Happier Parent, and then my first book, The Chicken Sisters, my first novel. I always wanted, like, writing a novel was the goal the whole time, but the nonfiction and the journalism felt to me to be more attainable and more acceptable as an alternative to being a lawyer.
It's a different process writing fiction and nonfiction in many ways.
Yeah, it really is. And I kind of messed with my nonfiction abilities by doing the journalism. But on the other hand, having a daily deadline for many, many years has left me as a person who, when I'm working on a project, I sit down every day, whether I want to or not, and whether I know what it's going to do or not, and whether the other project has gone well or not. So that I'm extremely grateful for.
That's great. What can you tell us about your new book, Playing the Witch Card?
So Playing the Witch Card, I'm delighted with this. It was a process, and I would love to get into this. But what this is, I like to think of it as grown-up Gilmore Girls meets practical magic. That's sort of the pitch that we've used for it. But what it is the story of a woman who really wants to push aside the magic parts of her and the ugly parts of her, and make herself a new life in a small town where she wishes she'd grown up, but she actually didn't. She takes over her grandmother's bakery, leaves her ex-husband behind, hauls her unwilling teenage daughter along with her, takes over her grandmother's bakery, is invited to make Halloween cookies for the town Halloween celebration by the town's very intimidating matriarch. And when she sets out to make just some ordinary, you know, black cats and moons and that sort of thing, finds herself instead recreating the family tarot deck in cookie form, which is very fun. And it turns out that tarot deck knows that there are secrets in Flair's life and in this town, and it is, for various and sundry reasons, determined that the truth will out. So it kind of goes on from there.
To be honest, I didn't know much about tarot cards before reading your book. I kind of had that tangential experience from movies and TV, and I found it fascinating. You yourself have had a long history with the tarot. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I did my, you know, began my tarot reading as your typical goth teen. So I did do that. And I stepped away from it for a long time. And I came back to it as an older adult, and really found in the tarot not a future telling system and not really a supernatural thing. I think our understanding of a lot of mystical things has really evolved lately. And the way that I see tarot cards is they're a storytelling mechanism. So there are sort of five very apocryphal stories within the tarot. And there are a lot of very typical, there's a lot of typical imagery. There's a lot of hero's journey. There's a lot of there's a word that I'm missing here. Archetypes, I guess. There's a lot of archetypes. And if you play with them and you pull them out and then you contemplate, you know, the meaning of the fool or the wheel or the hanged man, and you can really sort of look at where you are in your life and see, it's a great way to look at the forest when you're stuck up a tree.
That's great. What I especially appreciated and learned myself was when your character Flair was giving different people in the town cards, I guess that was my misperception. I always thought the cards predicted something, but it wasn't about telling you what was going to happen. It was about what might happen, what was possible for your future. Like one woman, the card foretold change, I think, and it was what she was going to do in her own life versus her marriage. So can you talk a little bit about
that? Also something that Flair wrestles with. She's kind of stuck believing that not all tarot cards, but these particular tarot cards are, you know, foretell the future. But when she reads, that's not how she reads. And it does not turn out, this isn't really a spoiler, that does not turn out to be the tarot card's mission. They've got something else going on. And there's something else happening with them that is why they are a very different deck of cards. But I think that's it's a common sort of misconception among people who don't have any interest in tarot cards. And B, it can be a way that they've been used in the past. It can be a way that people, I mean, it can be fun. It's a fun Halloween thing to read someone's future. But if you really want to dig in, if you really want to sort of explore yourself or your life or your own possibilities or the various stories that you're in the middle of, they're much more useful for that. I think that's a more modern take too.
That's interesting, because I think in some ways it might parallel, there's a lot of belief in like psychic powers and things like that, but sometimes it's just listening to your own intuition, that kind of innate sense that we all have that tells you, don't take that train or don't do this. It's just things you're picking up subconsciously that you're putting together.
Right. So when you look at a person and you either feel something good or you feel something bad, maybe it's not, you know, you're seeing little clues, not an aura necessarily. the idea of, you know, if you want to have some fun with the tarot, to use them to explore your own intuition, to pull a card and sort of think, well, how could this, you know, am I at the beginning of a journey about money and earthly things, or a journey of creativity? There's sort of different journeys within the cards. And, you know, this means nothing to me. I don't know what that would be. And then to think, well, I don't know, you know, could it? Do I want it to? Or is it something that I've put aside that I'd like to bring back into my life? Or maybe there's somebody around me that I could be looking. It's just, it's like, it's an opening. It's a lot of possibilities. And that is what within the book Flair sort of ultimately comes to, because one of the core things that is in this book is the idea that even if you do have access to real magic, it is still probably not going to fix your problems, which is such a bummer. I felt like that's been the whole nothing really fixes anything has been kind of a lesson of the last few years for me. And I don't know whether that's the way the world is going or the fact that I am getting older and growing up and having to face that there are no grownups. But I just over and over again keep realizing that nothing fixes everything, and nothing makes other people do what you want them to, which is so frustrating, really. So that's kind of the journey that Flair is on here, is wanting things to fit into her plan. And there's just that would be a very boring book. And also, that's just not what happens.
No, you're right about magic. You can't make people do something that you want them to with magic. You really kind of humorously illustrate that with Flair's ex, and how even when you bespell someone or bewitch someone, there's ways they can still make your life annoying.
Yes. And that is a key to writing any book about magic. If you're writing a book about a magical system of any kind and it fixes things, that's not, you're not done. you gotta get back in there, because only people can even change things. There's no, even in like your grand fantasy, which I love, it's never a book about, you know, fantastical magic saving a magical world. It's a book about people using magic and finding the way within themselves to save whatever, you know, whatever's at stake in any given story.
One of the other big kind of parts to the story is Halloween in Rattlesboro. Did you always know, yes, I want to set this book at this time of year? And what is it about Halloween that makes it now such a, I think it's like the second biggest holiday in the U.S.?
Oh, I actually have a huge theory about that. I love Halloween, and I have always loved Halloween, and I've written about this at various points. But I think the great thing about Halloween is you can do whatever you want with it. Oh. Like, your mother's not going to call and say, are you coming home from Halloween? Mm-hmm. You know, your grandmother does not have Halloween traditions that she expects. I mean, okay, Blair's grandmother does. But most of our grandmothers do not have Halloween traditions that, you know, they expect us to carry out. There's no burden. I mean, maybe you're in a neighborhood where there's a burden to, you know, really decorate and give out good candy. That's like a social burden. So that's my feeling about it, is that it is a Halloween, and we have really taken it. It's not associated with any religious practices. It may be within some lives, but the version of Halloween that we all love and decorate for is sort of whatever we want to make it. And I think people, I know that I've seized on that, and I think that a lot of people seize on that. And it's always been about the changing of the seasons and the, you know, shifting into a darker time of year. I live in New England. So as we roll past Halloween, you know, we hit a point when the sun doesn't come up till 8 o'clock in the morning and it goes down at 4:30. It's very depressing. So to have a sort of a celebration at the beginning of it is actually pretty great.
And if what I've read is correct, Rattlesboro does have kind of their big town trail kind of thing that brings in tourists and everything. That came about possibly from something you did on your own?
Yeah, I've always thought about making it bigger. So yes, in our family, we do, and we do call it the Spooky Trail. And we would send out invitations every year. And it started when my kids were so small that like it was like my neighbor Jason with a spider puppet, and he would have to like take his hand out to show our kids that, you know, it wasn't a real spider. And I had a witch hat on and my son cried, and we were, you know, we were, and then they got older and we got to get scarier, and it became sort of this, almost this test of my neighbors and my friends. Will you come here for Halloween and let me, you know, put you in a like black robe and stand you in the woods, possibly in the rain, possibly in the snow. And, you know, will you sneak out and scare the bejesus out of our children? Or, you know, are you the kind of person who's going to wimp out and reveal the secrets? So it's been huge fun. We stopped in 2020. My kids are also, the teenagers are really hard to scare. My husband has a joke that what we should really do is just point them out in the woods and then not do anything, because the whole time they'd be waiting for us to do terrifying things. Mm-hmm. So we haven't been able to do it again in the same way since 2020, and I miss it. And it also, I always had all these incredible ideas, like, you know, we're going to put a net up in the trees and you're going to be in this tree and you're going to be in there. We're going to drop the net. And A, people are like, you can't drop nets on children. And I was like, yes, you can. But B, it was often harder to carry out than I envisioned. So this was my way of like making the big spooky trail of my dreams. And also it was fun to sort of have like people walking this scary trail that have no idea A, what went into making it, and B, what's really going on behind the scenes, because there's going to be real magic. But I was able to point out that like, even when you want people to walk through a haunted house, they don't necessarily do what you think they're going to do. And that messes you up. And then you have to be ready for that. And that was always true, even with the little kids and the bigger kids and the teenagers. But yeah, we had huge fun with, I mean, everybody around here tells stories about that trail. And there's a number of kids out there who just cried at the beginning and refused to go after 1 year. So, hey.
Well, you've done your job. You've scared a generation.
That was how I felt. That was how I felt about it.
Your heroine, your protagonist, is a witch, as are other members of her family. It seems like in the last, I'm going to say five, it might be a little bit longer, years in publishing, there's been this whole like renaissance, this whole resurgence of witchy kind of romances and witchy novels and books featuring magic. What do you think is the sudden interest in readers' part in witchcraft and magic?
Well, I mean, a lot of that has been, a lot of that comes from women. Most readers are women. That is, it's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we went through the past decade, especially, there have been huge moments of feeling very powerless. Mm-hmm. And of having thought that we had gotten past a lot of that powerlessness, you know, feeling like we'd brought a lot of things out into the open and made changes that then turned out, you know, some of those things it turned on us as a gender, and things are not as we had hoped they would be, or as many of us had hoped that they would be. And I think that even, you know, women can have different opinions about the specifics of what's going on, but that sense that we still don't have the equal power within the world is with a whole lot of us. And so to go back to sort of pull out of our history this other secret thing that has traditionally been pretty female, that's gotten women in a lot of trouble before, but has also been a way to speak truth to power, to make changes, or to do things underground that, you know, might not be permitted above board. So I think there's a love for that. And I also think, you know, there's a real, like, I think we're kind of, I'm going to just speak for women and be kind of gendered, but I think there are a lot of people out there actually of both genders that are kind of like, you know, I like what I like. And if what I like is magical and mystical, or if what I like is fantasy, or if what I like is, you know, imagining vampires or dressing up as a Star Wars character, I'm going to do it and I'm going to be proud of it and I'm going to lean into it. And if you don't like it, I don't care. Like, you don't have to look like it. So I feel like that has allowed a lot of things to come out of the woods. Sure, witchy rom-coms, more witchy books, even more fantasy than we have seen in the past. Comic-Con, there's a word for the, cosplay. All of those things are much more out in the open than they used to be. And I think a lot of that is just, you know, being, it's a lot of people who are maybe not feeling like the world is turning out the way that they had hoped to, just saying, well, fine then, I'm gonna plant my flag and I'm gonna do me. You know, I'm still gonna hope the world changes, but I'm also gonna do me. So I think, I do think there's something to this. I don't think it's just, it is, you know, it's cyclical and there are trends, but I don't think this is the same as, you know, the vampire trend that we saw being so huge 15 or 20 years ago. I think this is part of a broader evolution. I hope so. I don't know. Cause yeah, I think it's fun. And obviously I love the witchy stuff. I read all of it. I really enjoy it.
I think you're right. I think also, this could just be my perception, but when it comes to genre fiction, we've gone over the centuries, each genre kind of experiences its moments where readers stop caring about what the world thinks. Like for years, mysteries, like in the 20s and the 30s and 40s, they were looked down upon as being inferior. And then romance was looked upon as being like, you don't want to read that in public, no one reads that. And they kind of said, we don't care, we're reading it. It became the biggest genre published in fiction. And now I think you're right, it's kind of this whole readers of fantasy, of magical books, of things like that. It's like they used to be kind of typecast or stereotyped as a certain kind of reader. Now they're just saying, no, it's everyone out there. There's all different kinds of readers.
And we don't have to read just one thing. I mean, I personally read very broadly, like, you know, one day you can be reading Salman Rushdie, the next day, you know, a book in Kindle Unlimited about a magic witch with a bakery, which is not even my magic witch with a bakery. It's a different magic witch with a bakery, because I happen to love a good magic witch with a bakery. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think we're just, you know, we're not only showing the Salman Rushdie reading part of us anymore. So I think that's really fun. I love it. I do. And I love all the, you know, all the bookstores and all the hype. I don't know. I really enjoy all of it. I'm a rabid, I love to write, but I'm a rabid reader as well.
We're going to touch upon that, because that's one of the things that's one of your best qualities. Before we leave playing the witch card, you've written three novels now, and there's another author I know who always talks about writers having a core story or something that you can see in each of their works. I can see some common, we'll use the word ingredients, in each of your books. There's usually small town setting. There's usually some kind of food woven into the story, and there's often some attempt to either repair or renew family relationships. How would you describe your novelistic core story?
I think my core story is about the struggle to figure out what makes us happy.
Oh.
And, you know, the small town thing is a lot of us think living in a small town will make us happy or it won't make us happy. The family thing is, it all kind of plays into that. Like, will I be happier if I deny this part of my family? Will I be happier if I bring this part of my family closer to me? They're all kind of about the mistakes that we make while trying to create a happy life. So that thematically, I think there's that. But you're absolutely right. There's always food. I'm doing it. I'm writing something again right now. Who knows if it'll ever play out, but it actually has mixed drinks and cocktails, but they're very foodie. And there's always an animal and, you know, there's always a setting, a town that has an influence on the people in the book. So that's what I like to read. So I think it's probably what I come back to for that reason.
Let's talk a little bit about your writing process, because you had written something that I thought was really quite interesting. You said, "I think probably my biggest challenge in fiction is making my characters do the stupid thing." Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I want them to be smart and I want them to be happy. And I think also it's a former journalist problem, which is that I have trouble pushing past the limit of, well, what would someone really do? And, you know, so often the answer, especially if you're trying to, when you think about it that way, you tend to think, well, what would be the right thing to do? And, you know, it's often, well, they would go talk to someone, you know, they would work this out amongst themselves. That doesn't make a good book. So yeah, I have often sort of had to go back and be like, well, no, you can't do the sensible thing here. But one of the fun things about playing the witch card is that there is no sensible thing. When she gets to the point where things are, and part of that is because it's magic and things are not sensible in this world. But when, you know, when she gets to the point when everything has gone wrong, there is no, you can't be sitting there shouting, but just do X or but just do Y. There's nothing. Like, she just kind of has to walk in there and figure out what to do. And that was something I liked about this, that nothing depended on, I mean, you know, I suppose, you know, if she'd made some better choices when she was younger, I don't know. There's always that. Like, it's always about what the character, who they are and what they do, but there's no smart thing here. So I had that trouble less in this one, but it is definitely, and I'm facing it in the thing I'm working on now. I just sit there all the time going, all right, what would be the worst choice she could make at this point? And why would she do that? Like, you know, you can't just be because book. That's
you can't
a
be
terrible
just
answer.
Stupid for stupid's sake. You have to have some reason for being.
Yeah.
It sounds like, and I could be wrong, your writing process for novels is character driven, or do you actually sit down and think about a story and plot it out?
It's a mess of both.
Okay.
I seem to have to write the novel and then just realize what the novel is going to be about and then write it again, which I'd really hoped I had grown out of, but I have already written one draft of this and the new draft is based, I mean, I'll pull chunks out of the old thing, but it's such a bummer. It'd be much nicer to just be able to get it down. But yeah, so it's a real mishmash. Like, I'll start with an idea, and then when I attach the characters to the idea and I start trying to figure out, well, who would that be and why would that be, then the character part of the story really takes over and drowns out the sort of initial spark of an idea. I mean, an initial spark of an idea that is in playing the witch card was the idea that your mom would show up with your ex in the trunk of her car. There was just something about that. And it probably has a little goodbye Earl element to it. A lot of things. And that did not turn, I mean, it certainly happens and it's fun, but it's not, you know, the core of the story is why and who would that happen to and who would these people be? And once you get that scenario becomes less important. I think Stephen King talks about the difference between a setup and a book. And so, you know, you might think, and I do tend to think of setups, but then you gotta take that and it doesn't, usually the setup is just, it doesn't turn out to be the most important piece. And sometimes it just fades away completely. And sometimes maybe you should just let it go, but that
That's what editors are for, I think.
Yeah.
It sounds almost like writing is the literary version of archaeology. You're like sifting down and digging the character out until you get to who it is.
Well, that's how Stephen King describes it, digging the dinosaur out. Absolutely, one toothbrush thing at a time. I don't know. For me, it's just getting deeper and it's making it harder and harder and harder. Like I write a story and it's sort of light and basic, and then I got to do a better job, and then I got to do a better job, and I got to do a better job. I had a professor in law school, oddly enough, where I learned a great many things that are not obviously applicable to my life, but definitely are. But I had a professor, Larry Lessig. He's actually pretty well known now for a variety of attempts to change the world of politics and political money. But anyway, I had written a paper for him, and he took a really long time to return it. And when he returned it, he was like, you know, this is fine. This is well written. It has some ideas in it. It's fine. I really think it could be better, and I'm asking you to make it better. Like, his exact words were something like, I hesitate to make you rewrite this, but I'm going to. And that's my process right there, is being my own Larry Lessig, and making myself do more.
You've written three novels now. You're working on another novel. I'm guessing that along the way you've learned a thing or two. If you could go back to when you were first starting out writing fiction, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, the smartest thing I did was to involve a professional editor who would help me find the story. So, you know, the advice I would have given to myself would probably be to do that sooner, or just to go ahead and I had that idea that's common to many of us, that if you buy Save the Cat Writes a Novel or any of the other books that offer a structure that's typical for novel writing, and then you follow it, you're cheating, and you're going to end up with something generic and formulaic. I don't think that's actually true. I think following the typical story arc, at least especially in your first draft and maybe your first novel, and paying attention to that and just accepting what readers expect and then trying to deliver it, that's the way to go to school about this. Like, you got to do that, to me. And I think there are a few writers out there who don't necessarily need that, but most of us would do better to go ahead and try to write the book that fulfills what readers need and helps you tell a story within a structure. And then, you know, maybe as you're redrafting it and as you're revising it, you play with it. So the advice I would give my younger self is don't write 120,000 words trying to reinvent this form. Go ahead, make another wheel. You know, it's okay. There's a reason the wheel is the wheel. And, you know, if you turn out to be Lauren Goff, then yay. But it's fine to just make a wheel first. And then, you know, maybe later on down the road, I don't know, you fly, whatever the metaphor might be.
One thing I especially love about you is just that you're not a terrific writer, but you're such an enthusiastic reader. The way that you love to share what you're reading, what you have read with other people is just amazing and endearing and something to celebrate. What can you tell us about why this is important to you? I believe you also may have some type of platform called #mreading that people might want to know about.
They might. So I've been I can't remember not being a reader. I can't remember not, you know, I was the kid who went through, you know, when I was in little, there was the box of the books and they were the different colors and you read all the green ones and then all the yellow ones and then all the, I don't remember, red ones, however it worked. And, you know, I was the kid who was done with the box by the end of October and the teacher was like, oh, okay, here, let's do something else. Like, it was never, I'm an only child. I grew up with, you know, great, very loving parents who both worked, or right, my mom went to college when I was small, so I was alone a lot. Books kept me company. Books gave me something to do when we were traveling and I didn't have any siblings around. We moved a lot. Books stayed with me where all my friends kind of tended not to, not because I wasn't a good friend, but because, you know, now we didn't live there anymore. So, you know, I had all that sort of typical lonely kid piece of it. And I just was an obsessive, and I'm also a very fast reader. And I think when you're good at something or perceived as good at it, and whether that really is good or not, I don't know. People reward you, and you know, it's rewarding in and of itself. So yeah, it's never not been a part of my life. I mean, I come in and out of the kinds of things that I like to read, and how much. I'm reading a lot right now. Maybe a month ago I was reading a little more slowly. I don't even know. There's not necessarily a rhyme or reason for it.
Do you ever experience reader's drought, which I guess is a version of writer's block?
Sometimes you just can't find the thing, right? Like you read, for me, I DNF, I do not finish a lot. Some of that is easier because publishers send me books. So if I don't pay for them, I don't feel quite as obligated. And I'm also willing to try almost everything. So I don't spend a lot, you know, I could probably be more selective and maybe have a better hit rate, but I don't know. Sometimes I think, you know, you might be in a period where you want to read the kind of thing that's in KU and you just want to zoom through stuff and you want to be a whale, which is the reader who just opens their mouth and sucks in all the romance or all the fantasy. And it's all going great. And then all of a sudden you read one that maybe would have been great 3 weeks ago and you're like, I'm bored. It's not doing it for me. And then there's this sort of, for me at least, this period of like trying a bunch of books to figure out, well, what am I in the mood for now? And I have had those moments when I've been like, maybe I'm so old and I've read everything, like nothing is going to feel new anymore and it's all over and I'm going to lose this piece, or worse, I've taken this thing that I love and I've turned it into a job. You know, and I can't read anything without thinking, well, I didn't write that. I didn't write that either. Dang it, I didn't write that either. That happens. And then the right book, you know, as long as you keep trying. And I think for me, I don't do anything else. I mean, I have hobbies and I have children but I'm not a big movie goer, and I find it really hard to sit still and watch TV. And my family loves to watch sports, and I do like sports, but I like sports as a backdrop for reading. So I just keep pulling it in, and eventually something will catch me. I think I was in a bit of a reader's drought in August, and then somebody handed me Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, and I had never read any Miss Brandon Sanderson. I know, obviously know who he is and that he's amazing. And man, I like what people like, right? That is a really good book, and I really enjoyed it. And once you get caught up and in the world again, it becomes, I think, easier than to get caught up and into different worlds. So now I have a huge stack of things I'm really excited about.
Is there anything you've read that we haven't seen yet that you'd like to give a push to, that's in the world?
Like that's coming, like in advance? Mm-hmm. I haven't been seeing. No, I've been buying the books of late. I mean, there's something I'm really excited about. I'm excited about Evie Dunmore's fourth book in her Gentlewoman's. I forget the League of Gentlewomen.
Yes.
Okay, I forget what she calls the series, but there's a rogue of one's own and something about the Duke and something about a Scotsman. That one's my favorite. Anyway, the fourth one of that is coming and I'm really excited, but I haven't read it yet. I have no doubt that it will satisfy me, but I haven't read it yet. And there's some witchy stuff out there on the horizon that I am excited about, but I haven't read yet. There's a witchy rom-com called This Spells Disaster that I think comes out next week. I'm excited about that. I have Lana Harper's newest. I haven't read it yet. I have Hazel Beck's newest. I know that Hazel Beck isn't really Hazel Beck, but I haven't read that yet. I have Erin Sterling. Wait, no, she doesn't have anything new this Halloween, actually. So anyway, I have a huge stack of fun books, but like I would imagine many of your readers, I haven't quite slipped into the fall witchy vibe yet. So it's still pretty hot and the leaves haven't even started to turn. So I've kind of got a growing stack of those. I just did Meg Cabot's Enchanted to Meet You. Yeah. It was fun. It was fun.
One of your early nonfiction books was helping parents get their kids to read. What advice would you give to parents who are out there that are thinking, how can I get my child or children to become more in love with what I like to do, read books?
I love this question, and I love it in part because I thought I had totally failed. So some of the things that I did when my kids were young were that we just had books everywhere that, certainly we had picture books everywhere stacked where they could get them in the bathroom. And then we didn't worry about them tearing them up or building things with them. Or if they had a book in their hands, it was all good. And we probably spent more money than we should have, but I didn't care. Like books were the, and if we were in a bookstore, this is actually still true and they all know it. We're in a bookstore and you want a book, I will buy it for you. I don't like, that is fine. Lots of times at the library, all that stuff. And then they all hit, you know, 12 or whatever. And largely they stopped. Like they really weren't reading. Couple of them reread Harry Potter over and over, and hey, they were reading something, and I love Harry Potter. They were reading something, so I was perfectly happy. And then there's just would be a long period when they would go months without reading, and I was really dejected because, you know, I read all the time. And now they're all teenagers. They're all, the youngest is actually 17, and they're not rabid readers, but my older daughter, who was the least sort of probably the least ready of them, at some point I realized I wasn't seeing her reading because she was actually reading on her laptop, like not her Kindle, not her phone, her actual laptop. This is not, and she was rereading the same horse book series over and over again for comfort. And at that point I was like, yes, yay. Like it was something she'd read when she was little, and she started to ask me for books. So she's gone through Evie Dunmore and she loves Alexis Hall. I just gave her Mrs. Nash's Ashes, which I think she's really going to enjoy. Yeah. She does not like fantasy. She did not like Harry Potter. None of that works for her. I got another daughter that I didn't think was reading. And then I realized she really digs like the David Leviathan. Is that those were working for her. And all of a sudden, oh, what did we just, my older daughter and I, we plotted, and my older daughter played an audio, the first couple chapters of Red, White, and Royal Blue. And now she's hooked and she's reading it. And one of my sons had a dishwashing job this summer and got hooked on audiobooks. My point being, I really didn't think this had worked, but my husband also reads. I read all the time. We're always sharing books with them. We have a take a beach vacation every year where all their dad and I do is read, but we don't really bug them. We just keep giving them stuff. And it seems to have worked. They all read for pleasure, at least a little bit. And I'm hoping, you know, that it will be more. So I guess my advice would be, this is very long-winded, keep trying. Oh, and the other fun thing that I used to do when they got old enough to, you know, beyond the picture books, is that I would take things that I thought they would like, and I would not recommend them, because obviously we went through a period where that did not work. I would just leave them places. Like I would leave them in the back of the car on a long trip. You know, I would throw them out in the living room as though they were just sitting there. And I, at the time, was also reviewing children's books. So we had a lot. And I called it seeding. I would like seed places with books and see if they would pick them up. We also always get, and still do, a print newspaper and a print copy of The New Yorker, because The New Yorker's gateway drugs are the cartoons. If you don't have it in print, nobody's going to see those. And to have the print paper sitting around and the headlines and stuff like that, I think it really, it's a reminder that it's out there. And also, I usually read in print so they can see what I'm doing. I'm not just holding a Kindle. I used to make a big deal out of that. Now it's more, it's just what I prefer. So those are my sort of scattered pieces of advice, are just have the stuff so that they can read it. You can't, I mean, Kindles are great, but I don't, there's so much else you can do on a digital device, even a lot of Kindles now. I think having the paper stuff around really matters.
I think that's very smart advice. And I think you're right to mention audiobooks. And I would probably add in, I guess, graphic novels and things like that. We always associate books with what we're used to, but that may not be how somebody else approaches a story.
Right. I actually love graphic novels. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've always made a point of getting, and also, like, I got them, the Wrinkle in Time is available as a graphic novel now. So I would make sure that kind of thing was around. And I'll, you know, grab Dogman or whatever. Maybe you're a very literary reader and Dogman does not float your boat, but it floats an awful lot of boats. So, you know, buy it, throw it around, scatter it so people can pick it up. Because I don't know about you, but my gateway to reading was not... I love me some Jane Austen, but my gateway to reading was not that. It was Trixie Belden, actually, mm-hmm. and Nancy Drew, and yes, Anne of Green Gables, but Babysitter's Club, that kind of thing. It's all good.
That's true. That's wise. We do have some questions from your many myriad of readers out there. So before we run out of time, let's try to get a few of those in. One of your readers says they love your book titles. How much input do you have with your publisher when it comes to selecting a title?
The Chicken Sisters, I just called Chicken, like Jane Smiley's Moo. I was like, just Chicken. I don't know. I thought it sounded more literary. And at some point, very early in the process of after we sold it, we were sort of doodling around with what it should be, and the Chicken Sisters just sort of popped up for all of us and was super obvious. And that's a really good title. And I also love the cover of that book. In Her Boots, I actually wanted to call The Modern Pioneer Girl's Guide to Life, which is the name of the book that is written within the book. My editor thought that sounded like people might actually think it was a Modern Pioneer Girl's Guide to Life. I was like, well, there's The Country Baker's Guide to Living. No one thought that was, but they won. And then I wanted to call it Wish You Were Her, which I still think is really cute.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we didn't. It has a serious SEO party problem. And Jodi Picoult came out with Wish You Were Here like 3 months before. So that's really why that one didn't fly. And it took us a while to come up with In Her Boots. And then Playing the Witch Card was originally, what was it originally called? That one took us forever. I called it, I called it Wild Card. So we actually end up sort of back and kind of close to what I had called it. And then when we sold it, I think we called it The Tarot Reader's Daughter. But then we all thought that sounded like a historical so that didn't really work. And we were brainstorming. We had lists like this, and it was my agent who came up with Playing the Witch Card. And now I can't imagine it being called anything else. It is truly the perfect title for this. So how much input? A fair amount, but not total. In Her Boots, I don't remember what In Her Boots was not my, I like it now, but it wasn't my favorite at the time.
Another reader wants to know, what is your favorite Halloween treat to get and to give?
My favorite treat to get, and the thing I fish out of my children's bars bags if they are trick-or-treating, is $100,000 bars. I actually wrote, I have the illustration for it here. I wrote an entire New York Times piece about all that sort of addressing a child with a bag of Halloween candy and explaining why there were all these things they would not like. So I was like, Heath bars, you won't like that. And I illustrated it. If you want, that's practically a health bar. You're never going to like that because I love those. Here's the $100,000 bar. There's a Twix. I don't, Sixlets. I like those bottle caps. Yeah, they know what I like though. If they get a 100,000 bar or a Heath bar, they're just like, here, just take it.
That's cute. Another fan wants to know, what is the scariest book you have ever read?
Ooh, so I have loved me some Rachel Harrison of late. I have not read Black Sheep yet. That is coming, and that's probably the one I sort of have intentionally not read it yet. I'm saving it. She wrote Cackle, which was not particularly scary, but and that one's like what it would be really like, the choice to become a witch and maybe scare all your neighbors, but live the way that you want to live. It's really fun. And then the other one is Such Sharp Teeth. And that's about really becoming a werewolf. Like really, like the visceral bodily horror of becoming a werewolf. And that's pretty scary. Or at least it's pretty horror, but I really loved it. And I think some of the reason I can only do horror if it's vampire horror or like werewolf horror, because I can feel pretty confident that I'm not going to get bit by a werewolf, but serial killer horror, I can't and I won't, and I don't. And Grady Hendrix kind of sits on the pinnacle or the tipping point of that. Yes. Where so that Southern Guide to Vampire Slaying, yes please. How to Haunt sell a Haunted House, which had not just puppets and clowns, but dolls. Mm-hmm. I finished that like this. But I did read it. So I think that might be the scariest book I've ever read. I do love Stephen King, but I can't do his, I can't do the ones again that might really happen.
Yeah, I think you might
have. Also the clown, I can't do that. No clowns.
No, you can take.
I did, however, at the end of one of our spooky trails, we had somebody pick the kids up at the end because they made him walk through the woods, and they're in my big. It was a big SUV because I had four hockey playing kids at the time. I still have four hockey playing kids, but I don't have to drive them all the way I used to. And they would pick the kids up and driving along, and they'd be like, "How was it? Did you enjoy the trail?" And then we had two kids dressed in the Stephen King It costume in the way back, and they leapt out. That was one of my favorite spooky trail moments. So deeply evil. I think I actually put that in here. I think it actually happens. It doesn't happen on this year's trail, but I think they reference it as something that had happened before. It might have gotten taken out. I don't remember. Anyway.
Almost out of time. You mentioned you're working on another project. Would you like to share anything about that, or shall we remain in the shadows?
It is so at the beginning. I can tell you it's a pretty true rom-com. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna lean into that piece of it. None of my books are really romances. This one's gonna be, so I think that'll be fun.
That's interesting. Before we have to conclude, how can readers find out more about you and your books? I know you have a website, you have several podcasts, or at least one.
So you mentioned hashtag amreading. That is my weekly email. It is on Substack, but it is totally free, and it is always going to be. You can find that the best thing to do is go to my website, which is kjdelantonia.com, and everything is there. But if you search KJ Delantonia on Substack, you'll also find hashtag and reading. I share a lot of books on my Bookstagram. So that's at KJDA. I TikTok, believe it or not. I think it's at KJ Delantonia. It's at KJ Reads and Writes. It doesn't, TikTok is weird. It's hard to exactly find people, but it's fun when you get into it. So, and I have a podcast called Hashtag In Writing, and that would be for all the writers out there.
Thank you. I've never seen an hour fly by so quickly. We've been honored to have with us author KJ Dell'Antonia, whose new book is Playing the Witch Card. I'd like to thank KJ for taking time to virtually be with us. And for all of you tuning in, thank you for joining another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.